This is the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. Your hosts, Sam Harris and Nicholas Farik, digest the most interesting, informative, and topical books, giving you their biggest insights. We expose different perspectives and tools to look at the world to make you wiser than yesterday.
Hi there, and welcome to the Wiser Than Yesterday podcast. This is new season, so I decided to start new instead of my hello everyone. Anyway, it's still Nico, and I'm still joined by Sam. And this is the first episode on our season on the human body. The first book that we decided to read was James Hamblin's If Only Our Bodies Could Talk, or If Our Bodies Could Talk. And so the author, James Hamblin, he's a doctor turned journalist. And in 2014, he launched a series, which was also called If Our Bodies Could Talk, for The Atlantic. And there he tried to answer in an entertaining and accessible way some of the big questions that people ask about their bodies and their health. And so he explores the human stories behind health questions that seem to never go away. And they often also tend to be mischaracterized and oversimplified by marketing and news media. And so in the series, but more specifically in the book, he covers topics like diet, sleep, aging, and he answers questions like, can I boost my immune system? Does caffeine make me live longer? How much sleep do I actually need? Is there any harm in taking multivitamins, and many other questions? And so in considering these questions, Hamblin draws from his own medical training as well from hundreds of interviews with distinguished scientists and medical practitioners. And he tries to translate his findings into very accessible, engaging, and socially contextualized answers. So Sam, what did you think of the book?
I like the book. I get annoyed when the title is sort of different because I at no point felt like it was the body talking.
No, I agree.
If I could understand what my body does, that would be fine as a title or something. I just was expecting some anthropomorph, like my body is telling me stuff, and it just that's not what the book was about, which was a bit confusing. And it was kind of entertaining, but it wasn't like funny. And it was sort of interesting, but it sounds like it's going to be more fun. Whereas like Bill Bryson, he looks for how absurd things are, and that he really makes it very amusing when you read his stuff. Whereas this was like, okay, it's just general interest. It was kind of like reading Wikipedia or like an encyclopedia about stuff. It's just like random little fact nuggets about your body, which was nice. I think maybe the order in which he told it as well, like I found the first part a bit more boring. I think if I was reading this by myself, I would have just stopped. I think it got better in the second half. Some more interesting discussions and things were in it. But it was fine as a book. I'm not sure I'd necessarily recommend it to that many people. I'd recommend chapters to different people about certain things. Or it would be great as a podcast form. There's a 5 chapters on like things about different parts of like the body and like sex sort of things. And you're like, okay, that's a cool podcast for an hour. Or there's a whole section about like surgery and plastic surgery and those two things. That's like another podcast for an hour if you're into that. But yeah, as a whole book, it maybe didn't need to be together. But yeah, I liked it.
Yep.
Can't complain.
Agreed.
I feel more knowledgeable having read it now.
Yeah, I agree. It made me think of one of my favorite books when I was young. This book is called Boys and Science, but I don't think it exists in English. It was written in Dutch. It was from a radio show where like two radio presenters with very entertaining personalities like started a radio show, but yeah, like you talked about on the podcast, and they would like have one question and they would start calling experts and just try to get the answer. And they talked about like it's all scientific, but they asked questions like, does it hurt to get decapitated? Or does a swimmer sweat underwater? Why do lobsters turn orange when you cook them? Yeah. And all these kind of random questions. And it's also very boyish, you know?
Yeah.
It's and that's why the title was pretty good. And it's one of my favorite books. It actually sparked my interest in science in general. And so it made me think of that, whereas like just some random things that like there's not one main theme, and it's just purely for entertainment purposes. So I agree. I think in general, if I would recommend books to people, they usually will have one main concept that they describe. For example, the next book in the series is going to talk about like one concept and describe everything around it. And I think those books are more likely to be recommended. And this book is more entertainment than specific knowledge. I agree with you as well. It tried to be funny and entertaining, but I never really laughed. We've had other books that didn't try to be entertaining, but made me laugh. And this one was a bit the other way around. So it was just probably just not my kind of humor. And so, because what he also did is he tackles a question and he tries to humanize it. So he doesn't talk about the specific, you know, parts, like, let's say we're talking about high carbohydrates, intake with the insulin response to that. Like he doesn't specifically go too deep into all the mechanisms that happen inside the body, but he tries to add on that like a human spin where he tells a story about a person who had that and experienced it and how they managed to solve it or not solve it. And in the end, that's how he describes it. And so sometimes I found these stories a bit too long. And after a while, I was just, I didn't even know what we were talking about anymore. For example, there was one part that talked about the heart and how doctors used to solve heart problems where like they were like burning parts of the heart. And so that part, I have no clue what they were talking about. There's just too much stories and too complicated, too much complicated stuff.
Although each section was kind of interesting, there was no specific narrative, and like it wasn't like you started at the start being like, okay, we're going to talk about the appearance of people and how that relates to things, and then you're going to go into sex, and then you're going to be like how you deal with sport. Like there was no explanation of what the order would be or why, and it was just very random, and you didn't know if like the next chapter was going to be a continuation of what you just listened to, or if it was going to be like, okay, and now you're going to be going on to the next part. And it was just all, you just felt a bit like blind, and it would have been nice to have a bit more directionality in the whole thing, I guess.
Agreed. A bit more structure.
Yes. But anyway, I think we can dive into the cool things that we like. There was like lots of cool things, and there's also lots of things that were a bit boring. So hopefully you can just listen to all the fun stuff in this episode and you don't have to worry about the whole book.
Agreed. One thing that I learned was specifically about supplements. So I do take supplements. I take creatine, HMB, beta alanine. Also take vitamin D supplements. That's pretty much it. Also whey isolate protein powder. It's also something I take. So I do take kind of a lot of supplements. And so what I learned was that the distinction between supplements and drugs, or like medical drugs, is the fact that they are approved by the FDA. And so all supplements would like to be called drugs and be able to be prescribed, but they haven't been able to get through the FDA process, which means that there's no real proof that they actually work. I find it interesting because I if you consider taking supplements, I would highly recommend the website examine.com. It's a website, and they just pool all of the research on certain supplements, and there you can read and find if they work, if they don't work. And so the supplements that I take, they say that they work, but apparently these products and supplements have not found FDA approval, and so haven't been turned into some kind of like drug that you can buy in a pharmacy. And so I always thought first that supplements were like always legit, or most of the time legit, which is not true. And also thought that, for example, when he talked about multivitamins, I was of the belief that if you take too much multivitamins, it's not a big deal, because if you take too much, you'll just pee it out. But he, again, and I heard rumors about this, but he points to the fact that it could actually be harmful to you to take multivitamins.
Yeah, that was an interesting chapter, definitely. Because there has been a lot of, like, okay, you should be taking more vitamin D at the moment with lack of sun and these things. And that does seem like there's a few things that probably are worthwhile if you're lacking. But in general, yeah, you can really overdo these things. And it was quite funny, the whole he hates on milk for a long time, of people like over supplementing on just milk for extra vitamins and calcium and things. And then it's like the leading nations in consumption of milk are also the ones with the highest osteoporosis, which is like the thing they're supposed to be taking to stop happening.
Yeah. So true. Yeah, because he also talks about like the egg mafia almost, or the egg industry and all the companies that produce eggs that actually are at the basis of lots of the stories about eggs. Because I've always been a big fan of eggs, and I never liked people saying like you can only have 2 eggs a week because the cholesterol will, you know, clog your arteries and get you killed. And so I tend, like, on average I eat like 2 eggs a day or something.
Yeah.
Really like them, and I think they're really nutritious. But listening to the book, I realized that I might be biased because a lot of the health fads, even the ones that are as benign as eating, you know, eggs, could come from companies that are incentivized by you eating their products, basically.
Yeah, definitely. So there's been lots of evidence in science saying that, like, okay, egg cholesterol is actually good and like it helps lower your cholesterol, but it's basically all been funded by egg companies and stuff. So you're like, oh great, but it should be reputable science. But it's just interesting to sort of see that maybe they're not quite as healthy as some things have said. But I don't think that's like a bad thing, but it's just nice to kind of investigate where your information is coming from a bit more.
And I also think this whole discussion, any hints to that as well, is like, let's say, like, who should do the research on eggs? Who should be paying for that? Because it's not necessarily a bad thing that that egg companies sponsor research that researches eggs. Because if that research shows that eggs are very nutritious and very healthy for you, it's beneficial for those companies. Obviously, they should also allow, which might be different or more difficult, if the research comes back negative, to have that research published as well. But yeah, I think this whole question of who funds the research for certain things is an interesting one.
So it's kind of nice having sort of the EU and these kind of things where they do fund a lot more science and stuff. It's a bit annoying, like Brexit happening. Yeah, I think on this area, on the vitamin side of things, it was quite interesting to hear some of the backstory around before they ever discovered what a vitamin was. It was more like a anti-scurvy thing. So like vitamin C, before it was named, was like the anti-scurvy disease sort of medicine. And there were other ones for different things. And then I think certainly for like vegetarians, it is useful to have your B vitamins and iron. Like I've been anemic a few times because I don't take iron up very well. And then if I'm not eating meat, then that's obviously like a double whammy on that. But they go through things and they summarize the, you know, that age old adage of just eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Having gone through the entire sort of, they talk about the meat industry and like a high fiber diet being more important than too much meat and stuff. And that's the general conclusion I seem to get from basically any book about what to eat.
I'd like to get back on that, but first I find it interesting. I never really understood what vitamins were or what they did. And so I think the public perception about vitamins is also pretty wrong. So the way I looked at them, what I described before, where it's like, it's something your body needs. And if you take too much, you just pee them out. It actually doesn't work that way. And so it's also the case that vitamins have, like, vitamin A almost has nothing to do with vitamin B and has nothing to do again with vitamin C. They're just completely different compounds that for some reason your body really needs. And so if your body doesn't have one vitamin, it can cause some kind of issue within your body. For example, if you don't take vitamin C, which they had when they were traveling the world by boats or ships, you would get scurvy and you would start bleeding and eventually die. And so that's why vitamin C, which was called different, became, you know, a vitamin and essential for vita, which means life. And so that's basically what the vitamins have in common. It's just the fact that they're essential. But that doesn't necessarily mean that if you eat a shit ton of them, that is going to help you. It's just going to help you avoid that specific disease. And actually it might be detrimental to your health as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, there's some that you do naturally pee out and it's just like really expensive pee and it's just pointless. And there are others that do actually store up. So I think you can over, is it vitamin B or vitamin D? Like actually it's quite sort of toxic to have too much of. Certainly like iron, you can have way too much iron. I had a friend that had like, he got some real health issues around that because he wasn't getting rid of it fast enough. and stuff. And
interesting.
Yeah.
It made me think back to our good old friend, Nassim Taleb, with his view on anti-fragility, where our body evolved in certain ways and we ate in certain ways. And now, you know, today we try to hack that. And in some ways we are managing to hack our bodies with, for example, going to the gym. You know, if you lift heavy weights, in specific movement patterns, it's going to make your bones and muscles stronger. And so there we've understood, we don't really know exactly how it works, but it works. And so out of experience, we see that it works. Once we start talking about supplements, the story becomes incredibly much more complex. For example, if you're talking multivitamins, if you consume multivitamin, the other nutrients that you consume it with are of importance. And so we don't fully understand yet. For example, if you take a multivitamin pill and you eat it with a bag of chips, or if you take a multivitamin pill and you eat it with a salad, if there are different effects to that. And so there, Taleb would say, it's too complex, not yet understood. So it's probably safe to fall back on the way we used to do things, which is not taking multivitamins and just eating healthy food that sustains life for so long.
Yeah. More plants.
He mentions it somewhere at the end that he is a vegan or a vegetarian himself. And I'm not vegan or vegetarian. And I felt that there was a bias there from his part where he was very much in favor of the whole vegetarian way of life. And he was saying plant-based is probably always the best. He wasn't really in favor of meat or even eggs for that part, or even and milk, for example. He didn't say that don't eat eggs or don't drink milk, but it's just a feeling I got towards the end. And then suddenly he said that he was a vegetarian himself. Maybe I'm biased myself because I enjoy meat, and I don't want to. There's this cognitive dissonance where I don't want to believe in the science that proves that meat is unhealthy for you.
Maybe we should read some more books on that then. In this,
we should definitely. I felt that there was a bit of bias there. Although I still try to eat a lot of vegetables, but I also like a steak once in a while. Anyway, that's one feeling that I had that I didn't like the fact that I had the feeling. So I would have preferred if he would have been a meat eater that would have said these things, you know, that would have made it more credible for me.
Same way with the Why Buddhism Is True book. It came from a guy that's kind of an angry person, didn't like meditation, as opposed to I've been a yogi since I was five. So I guess my next section of notes was on probiotics, which is kind of in this area of what to eat and stuff. And he just talks about it's you kind of have no idea what you're even buying off the shelf because it's pretty random the way microbes survive in these different environments. And so you're just getting a sort of random selection box that you're putting inside your body. And there's definitely possibly a bit of benefit from yogurt and kefir and these things, but it's not as much as you expect and you don't really know what it's going to do. And just a bit chaotic. You just have these random sort of seedlings, you've no idea what will actually grow inside you that well, and this sort of there's so much other stuff going on, or based on your genetics and these things, it's a bit hard to know. I think the individualized medicine stuff, so if you do actually regularly get yourself sampled every month to actually see what you've got going inside you, and then sort of going to eat the right specific foods to help culture stuff, and you have your genome sequence as well to see how you react to stuff, then you can actually be effective with probiotics and food to engineer your bacteria, but otherwise you basically have no idea what you're doing, and whatever's on a package is probably not true. And so it's something I've learned anyway around food packaging is I just don't whatever's on the top of it, I just don't really listen to. It's just I just look at what's in the ingredients and what the actual nutritional information is. And people, my mum will buy me some healthy yogurts, and I'm yeah, but it's sort of, it's fat-free, but it's still full of sugar, or the other way around. And you're this has nothing to do with what I actually wanted. And it's super annoying when you get people to shop for you and they don't look at what they're actually buying. They just sort of go on branding. You're for fuck's sake.
It's Sam doesn't have a lot of fat. So I don't think he'll he'll probably like this fat-free yogurt.
Yeah.
Yeah. That made me think of one of the things he discusses as well, is the gluten-free fat and all these kinds of fats.
Yeah.
Where he discusses gluten-free, and that, so basically what he says in the book is that there's a very, very small percentage of people, and I think it's only 1 or 2% who are actually gluten intolerant, which means that they have celiac disease, which means that the bodies create like an autoimmune response the moment gluten enter the colon. And so that is dangerous and is a valid reason not to eat gluten. But people starting to avoid gluten suddenly because it's supposed to be healthier. He says that there's zero proof that this is in any way effective.
Yeah, it's probably less effective because of, you then have to have like all the gluten-free alternatives, which are often not so healthy. Like that's just
Or more processed.
Yeah. And so,
As a counter argument there, I would like to raise the anti-fragile thought that humans developed or evolved in a certain way, eating mostly, you know, roots, vegetables, some meat, lots of nuts and seeds, and that gluten only became part of our daily diets, let's say 10,000 years ago or so. And so human bodies evolve quite slow, and it could be that we've fully adapted to gluten. But I can imagine that if you avoid gluten throughout your whole life, so you don't eat bread, you don't eat pasta, but you also don't try to substitute for it specifically, like you don't eat like fake bread or gluten-free bread. You try to focus more on it. Let's say you want to have something starchy or something high carb. You eat a potato or something. I think it's probably a healthier way of living than
as long as it's not chips.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. So, in general, I would say that less processed, better. Not processed, best of all.
Definitely. It's sort of with most of those sort of any kind of extreme diet and stuff. It's in your own home. It's really good, like keto or veganism or those things. You can do a really good job of it when you have like all the tools to make like a really healthy version of it. But as soon as you go to like restaurants and like it's not well equipped, like you often end up eating chips or like something that's not good, and the lack of optionality can make it really hard to be healthy. Depends on what your lifestyle is that goes with the diet that you're doing. I seem to have found.
So I think it's already clear that Sam and I are very interested in nutrition in general, and that, I mean, personally for me, I noticed that like these are most of my notes. I didn't make too many notes on the other subjects, although he talked about, you know, itches.
Yeah, that was actually quite an interesting section. I haven't got notes on that, but it was kind of fascinating, the whole like different, like it was just, didn't even know what was causing an itch. It just wasn't clear on any normal part of your nervous system and things, but it's a mix of all of them, but none of them and stuff. And it's really like a weird thing that happens to you. I quite like the discussion on life and death. If you want to go into that bit, I made some notes on that.
Go ahead.
Cool. So he talks about, there's a nice discussion about like, is life long enough? Which is something I've always thought, humans are going to always want to live longer. Like no one wakes up one day and is like, yes, I don't want to walk up the stairs today. That's something I don't need to be able to do with my life and that kind of thing. You want to, if you never actually like any day-to-day aging that you go through, but people sort of seem to think that they want to die at some point, but it's just the process of what happens to your body and everything else that sort of makes you go that way. But if that didn't need to happen, you wouldn't want to die. And they just go into like, okay, what aging is, which is just certain cells like senescing, and sort of basically it becomes like a whole disease across your body, and actually it doesn't necessarily need to happen. Like lobsters technically just don't get any older, their actual cells and things, or like the cells that are actually in your sexual organs that produce the new versions of you, well, that become your children, they are completely healthy, sort of fresh cells starting from you, that there's no genetic problems going on with those things, and like they create like a new person that has like completely fresh organs inside it. And so you can technically live forever once you start targeting these different sort of actions that happen within the body that sort of become the what is thought of natural process of aging, but it's technically not required. And so as leading people like Aubrey de Grey, who I did have on my podcast last year, who was super cool, who's trying to like make people live forever, and just like the whole debate of whether people should live forever or like longer, and what length would be a good life, I kind of found kind of interesting. I don't know what you feel. Do you think like people should live for 1,000 or like 100 years? How long do you want to live for? Would be my immediate questions.
So first point I'd like to make is I'm currently reading a book called The 100-Year-Old or The 100-Year Life. Which is I'm not that far, but they actually make the case, and they say that if like a person who's born today in the West has a 50% chance of reaching 110.
Nice.
And so for you, Sam, and for myself, we have a 50% chance of reaching 98 to 100.
Yeah.
And so 50% chance, that's insane. Like 50% of people of our generation, and I consider us like in like the healthy part. So yeah, we have a relatively good chance of making it towards like more than 100. So anyway, so that's how crazy aging has like advancing, like the, so how crazy science is becoming at keeping people alive. Now, next question, of course, is then to answer your question, because I heard that, but I might be wrong there, that all of the cells in your body refresh or like get recycled and like every like 2 months or 3 months you have new skin, and every 7 years you have new like lungs or whatever. I don't know the numbers by heart, except for the brain, I thought. I'm not sure, but let's say that if I could press a button that would keep me in my current physical age forever.
Yeah.
I probably do that, because it gives you, you know, the optionality. If you are just sick of this life, you can always decide to step out of it. And hopefully there's like a very easy, painful way to do that. That being said, the moral consequences of having unlimited time might be like really crazy to handle. And I haven't thought too much about that. But my initial, I've already thought a bit about this, and I would say that given the optionality, I would always go for it, as our friend Taleb would also say, always take the option, you know. It could, I mean, have you seen Altered Carbon?
No.
Oh man, you should see the first season. Second season, horrible. First season, amazing, and the concept is also brilliant. But it talks and it describes pretty well what will happen if once humans find a way to prolong life indefinitely. And as a very, very short summary, not about the plot, but about how the world looks, is there's like a very small elite of ultra, ultra, ultra wealthy people who don't die. And they're actually almost unkillable because they have like replicas of their consciousness, like stored in the cloud and whatever. And so the rest of the world is just, you know, scrambling around. So you have like a few elite who own almost like everything, and they're super rich, and they have like these super extravagant parties where people die for their pleasure, which makes sense. Wow. Because I mean, you can always like get reborn some way, but for the rest of the humans, it's not that nice. Anyway, that's Altered Carbon. Must watch show, especially the first season.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. I would love to watch that. That's definitely my kind of thing. I do feel sort of the same when you look at Ready Player One kind of thing. Also, where our lives are going is, if we can live somewhere digitally or like just do some more fantastic things, it's like our lives are increasingly meaningless as the wave of progression happens. So like, okay, there's less and less stamp you can make on humanity in the world as there's more people doing less and less significant things. As in, you know, if you had a good brain many years ago, you could be the person to invent like Pythagoras' theorem or like Newton. Like, what if Newton was around right now? He'd be like maybe lucky to perhaps make a difference in like the tile plating of a SpaceX sort of rocket. Like, that's still pretty cool, and pretty, you've got to work your whole life to be the person that does that, but it's not like the groundbreaking next level principles of maths that's just going to change the entire way the world works, because you just can't have that effect so much, which is sort of sad as a human. But if you can live in like a virtual reality where you can be Harry Potter or you can like be slaying dragons, like you maybe find much more meaning. Yeah, and if you can do that forever, like what's wrong with having those lives? It will be interesting.
I am, to get back to your point, I think I have the feeling that with technology, inequality will always grow.
Yeah.
It will always keep growing, just because, as you said, Pythagoras, for example, he was a brilliant dude. But during his lifetime, he, like, his knowledge and his capacity, he could only share it with like a handful of people.
Yeah.
Like, back in his days, 99.9% of Greeks probably didn't knew who he was. Because and just through technology today, if you are capable, I think you are able to exponentially grow and spread that capacity. If you're looking at education, for example, one of the things that a lot of companies and people are looking into is why don't we, because right now a lot of classes are going on online where there's almost zero interaction between teachers and pupils because the students are just sitting there and with the black screen because they don't want to show their face. And so the teacher is talking to their computer. And so why are we now not like paying the best teachers, let's say the best math teacher in the world, you know, millions of dollars and just having millions of school children follow that, those classes because he's going to be the best at explaining it if there's no interaction anyway. And so there, I think we'll see that, you know, the best teachers, and obviously it's not going to be one, it's going to be a few, but they're going to reap all the rewards and people that are average will, you know, be left out.
In a way. And then all the people that create the technology to let like the peer interaction of self-learning. So like you have like the best teacher and then besides that, you just need the technology to help like the people like.
And they have the best builder of that technology as well. So it's always going to be like the, because of technology and the zero marginal costs of providing services with technology, it's going to be like equality is going to grow.
Yeah.
But I have the feeling we strayed off our, you know.
Yeah. Death topic. But it's definitely where the world's going, but it's fine.
Yeah.
It's interesting, yeah, I think. Back to the aging and death thing, there's a few, one point like I really liked. So it says that we don't fear missing out on the years before our birth. So no one fears like the age 12, 15 that they weren't around in that time, even though like, it might've been scary to actually have been there, but we fear death. The reason we fear death is that we fear a world without ourselves in it. And we fear the world going on without us. And that I thought was like really cool and interesting and just sort of slightly absurd and stupid when you realize it, but just nice to be like, yes, what's wrong?
Well, I would make a counter argument there because there's a difference between the years before your life and the years after. And that is, I think, just relationships. Yeah. You know, let's say that I have a kid or, you know, grandchildren, you're like 70 years old. You have some kind of terminal disease and your grandkids are just like learning how to walk. And, you know, it's, I think it's quite normal that you're going to fear to miss those years because you've already, like you have an investment, there's people, you know. And so there I can understand that there's some fear. And at least I can understand that there's more fear there than there is for a time where you weren't born. And so you didn't know anyone except your parents, which are younger in a way. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had this discussion recently with my girlfriend as well, that the like death is a very weird concept and with most people provokes sadness if someone passes.
Yeah.
But it doesn't have to, I guess. Like there's ways, I think, how you can, I don't know, feel non-sadness, not necessarily happiness, but contentment, I guess, with it. I don't know.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. As in being dead, there's nothing wrong with being dead. It's like it's a nothing thing.
Yeah.
So it's not that sad for the person. And you can kind of be grateful that like they were in your life and you got to know this nice person. And okay, it's sad that you can't speak to them anymore, but you can still think about what would they tell you to do in these circumstances, and you can still carry some of their personality with you in that sense, which is nice. And certainly the whole like just being sad about it is like a massive waste of time, as in okay, if that person loved you because they're close to you, then the last thing they're going to want you to do for the next like year of your life is be sad and mopey and useless. Like they wouldn't want you to go and smash it and live your best life and be super happy. So probably go and do that. It's
yes.
Logic wise.
I totally agree. Yeah.
Sort of silly. Yeah. That's all right. My thoughts. I guess, I mean, we've been going a bit long, but like the one other area that I found really interesting was the whole area of like sex and sexual parts and how we talk about it and stuff. So I don't know if you made any notes on this, but I made a few notes.
Go ahead. Share them.
Okay. So firstly, on like maleness, as in, I think on both sides, we do perform to like stereotypes based on the expectations of society. But this means that men are worse at asking for help. And so we're much more likely to lose friends along the way and also suffer health issues from not going to the doctors, which leads to like a double whammy on like one of the reasons why men have a shorter life expectancy is actually that we don't ask for help as much from doctors and things. So we're more likely to have like a medical problem. And we just don't get the mental health support either from our friends. Mm-hmm. We don't talk about our feelings. We're not sort of expected to talk about our feelings or say these things. And so we're much more likely to just commit suicide. Whereas women, yeah, they're four times less likely or five times less likely to commit suicide
or die by committing suicide.
They just sort of, they seem more like emotional and down about things, but they probably have just as much negative emotion. They just sort of express it and then get it solved. Whereas men just hold it inside them and it kind of eats away at us. So that was a thing, which...
Yeah, it spoke to me, I think, that part, because I've realized that I'm very bad at sharing emotions, and especially I'm very bad at being vulnerable.
Yes.
I just cannot be vulnerable, and it's really bad. And my girlfriend always says like, oh, it's okay. But I'm like, yeah, for some reason, I don't know why. I don't like being vulnerable.
Yeah, it's a hard one, but it's a very powerful thing. And actually, when you can do it in the right way, it is quite manly, because it shows that you're comfortable with yourself and actually able to sort of say these things. So maybe we could read some books on vulnerability.
Actually, I think that would be something that would help me a lot. It's indeed reading books on that, and then obviously trying to use that in your life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. That's an area of interest.
That's
but big one to unpack.
The book is sparking some interesting conversations. It's surprising.
Yeah, I think it would have been much better as a podcast of like to actually kind of just go and spark like a bit deeper into these things and talk interesting stuff. Then there's a whole just area of like, oh, actually similar on this section of vulnerability of women who can talk about what makes sex work for them are 8 times more likely to be happier in their relationship. So again,
8 times.
Being able to be vulnerable with your partner and actually just say things is pretty big. And I don't know about you, but personally, like people that you don't really have like that much rapport with on sort of, and when that ends up having sex, it's like, it's just not as good. So I've never really been that into like one night stands and stuff, 'cause I'm just like, it's just kind of weird. Whereas people that I can make laugh, it's like, it just doesn't matter if something goes wrong. So we're just carrying on laughing about it. And then you work it out and like, then everything's fine. And like nothing ever really goes wrong. And so, yeah, I just find it odd that people can't actually, or go for the relationships where they can't actually express themselves and talk about these things, because it's kind of like the essential part, like I'd have assumed.
Yeah, I've noticed that there is like a disparity between what your, at least mine, you know, I feel, and I think that a lot of men have this, there's like a draw, you're drawn to women or mates that you haven't had sex with in a way, you know, because, you know, we have evolved to be like, if you were able to spread, to spread your genes, have sex with more different women, then I mean, that's a trait that was passed on through the generations. So there, I agree that for some reason, so men, we still are drawn towards new, and that's why also like pornography is so popular. You know, we want to have sex with as many women as possible. But on the other hand, you're absolutely right that sex with one person, with open communication, is probably the best thing, that like the best sex you can have. So yeah, there's a big difference there.
Yeah, no, exactly. Just being happy in your relationship is pretty cool. So investing in, well, not being a man about it and being like a vulnerable, like, oh, is this what works for you? And making the other lady feel comfortable about talking about what works best is going to make the person much happier, more satisfied than assuming that you're the best person at sex ever and that you're going to nail it the first time, because you're probably not. And everyone's kind of different, because people go on to about uniqueness. And also like I was saying about like the way they did this could have like been better like narrated, as in like what you spoke about, as in the men wanting to be gene spreaders, like links perfectly into a different chapter that wasn't linked at all in the book about the penis having the bulbous sort of end, and that sex, like compared to sort of lions or some animals where it's like 3 thrusts takes sort of 20 seconds.
Done. Yeah.
It's like, okay, it's requires quite a lot of thrusting, and which was evolved to pull semen out of the vaginal canal to make it more likely that you're going to be the dad because of the other person's semen is no longer in there, which relates directly to trying to spread your genes and stop other people from...
Opportunity missed, clearly. Yeah.
Anyway, but that was an interesting segment as well. Other things, and then just like just general why things are the way they are was kind of interesting. So apparently one of the most popular things on the internet is just searching for penis size, and in case you didn't know, the average penis size is 5.1 inches, which I thought it was bigger, so that's kind of good news. But then people don't know at all, this is one of the things I talk about, is that people have very little awareness of like what a clitoris is or how big it is. And I feel like I've learned this and forgotten it, because it's not just like the bit on the outside. It's like it goes inside and it's much longer, and it's actually, I think it's like 3 centimeters unerected and can go to like 7-8 centimeters on average erected, and it kind of grows, and there's actually like a whole part inside that is technically the clitoris. And I was like, oh well, there we go.
Yes,
that's some information.
Learned something new.
Yeah. So like, and plenty of women don't even know much about this, because all we learn about is like penises mostly, and seems a bit wrong.
There you go. Clitoris, pretty big.
Yeah.
Cool. With that said, I think it's a perfect note to end the episode on, and maybe go into ratings.
Two more points on this.
Two more points.
Yeah. Shoot. So, well, I'm not sure. One talks about like the rise in porn and the way that's sort of affecting our stereotypes of what a body should look like, instead of women like suddenly getting a lot more hair removal to fix that. But then you can suddenly see the labia a lot more. And so there's like a huge rise in surgeries to sort of change what they're like, which is just an interesting fact and kind of absurd on why we're changing ourselves so much compared to what we used to be. And then also found the way that the stereotypes of what boob size people want interesting. So men generally prefer larger busts because of it can be a sign of fertility, and on the whole gender of like, okay, wanting to have as many children as possible, women with like big busts are probably going to have more children for you, we think, even though it's kind of actually not at all true. But also studies have shown that it can be very random based on just how hungry a man is at the time. As in like physically hungry, like wanting a biscuit, but it's the boobs. But also like two big boobs sort of then indicates sort of that maybe the person is pregnant and stuff. So like actually people with that is kind of off-putting, or maybe actually have back problems because the boobs hurt them and stuff. And it's just, I think talking about bodies and sizes and shapes and stuff is always kind of interesting. So I found it interesting. So there we go. Filled in on that. And
cool.
Now we can go to reviews.
Go ahead.
So I gave it a 4 because there was lots of interesting stuff, but as we spent the whole first 10 minutes complaining about it, just, was a bit unordered and scattered. And like I had to really make notes on all of these things. Like I've basically forgotten anything I didn't make a note on, and it just it wasn't tied together. And yeah, I think if I'd read the book without doing this podcast on it, like I'd be like, yeah, you learn some stuff, apart from I can't tell you what any of it was.
Yeah, true. Yep. All right, fully agree. I was also going to give it a 4 for the exact same reasons. I think it's a nice book. It's fun to read, and I think because I felt like some of the things, or many of the things actually, I already kind of knew, so I didn't learn that many new things, because I'm already quite interested into health and stuff. So if you're new to it, I think you might take out a lot. But in general, it didn't really make me wiser. So it didn't like give me a new way to look at the world. It just gave me some nuggets, some facts. The only like thing that I can take with me is more about, you know, the question of who sponsors the research, what will might influence like the way I look at new insights in health, for example. But apart from that, not many crazy things. All right, so that rounds up this episode. For the next episode, we will be reading the book Why We Sleep, Unlocking the Power of Sleep and Dreams, written by Matthew Walker. So it's going to be completely different. It's going to focus more on sleep, on one topic. And so hopefully that's going to be interesting. So looking forward to that, and speak to you then. Bye.
Thanks, TK.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you like what you heard, feel free to give us a rating and share with your friends. If you'd like to ask us a question or give us a comment, feel free to join us on Reason. Reason is Sam's startup that is building a social podcasting app. It is a place where Sam and I listen to podcasts and share ideas and insights. It'd be great if you would hang out with us there. Thanks again, and speak to you in the next episode. Cheers.